It's a container of some kind, an assignment, top priority, from them.
Well, then it is exciting. Well, aren't you going to open it?
No, I'm not meant to. It's only meant for one person and creature. It were only open for...
Paul to open.
Paul to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
Unpeople, undoing unthings, untogether.
Diseased?
Who knows? Perhaps they're right.
All we're going to do is switch on now and see what happens.
Whether they're ready for it or not.
Here come the drums!
Hello!
Hello! And welcome to Pull to Open, an ongoing quest to watch all of Doctor Who, the entire television program, in random order. I'm Pete Paschal.
And I'm Chris Taylor, and sometimes we do these intros in random order, not in the order we expected. And sometimes we both want to say hello to you, dear listener, because we're so excited to be
excited
on this random quest with you.
Exactly.
So excited with what we've got for you today, a thing that you may not necessarily, if you're a Doctor Who fan, be excited about, but let's set it up.
Let's set it up.
If you will.
Previously on Pull to Open. Three stories ago, guys, we were in the Tom Baker era. We were in the middle of the Key to Time saga with a little episode called The Pirate Planet, written by one Douglas Adams. And we departed Zanac and got in our TARDIS and went back in time chronologically, way forward in time in the show to another part of the Tom Baker era, the early part. And we were on the Ark in Space, the far future. So
not set in the 30th century.
Not set in the 30th century, way beyond it. And the randomizer, which has been rocking us through this journey, really took a liking to future history.
It's and so good.
Decided to give us the beginnings of the Earth Empire in a pretty epic tale called Frontier in Space, which is also
26th century
and sort of unofficially known as the Master's Dalek Plan. And then it's time to see the decline of that empire. And it actually happened in the season previous. And so this is taken us to season 9, serial 4, The Mutants.
Yes, and I should say I feel responsible for bringing us here, because what I asked the randomizer at the end of last week was, hey, I kind of liked the well-drawn empires of Earth and Draconia. I liked the political intrigue there, like the fact that there was some nuance of, you know, debate within each empire. Show us some more of that. Show us some kind of knotty political space opera-y stuff. And
and behold, it served it right up. It was like, boom, you want it? You got it.
I'm not sure I really got the dish that I asked for. This is definitely one of those moments where the dish comes back in the kitchen and I'm looking at what everyone else at the table has gotten and thinking, I really shouldn't have ordered this. It sounded good. I'm not sure. It's kind of this rainbow of color on my plate and it looks really weird.
You know, anyway, when we talk about why the randomizer brought us here, I think we can just skip that one because it just completely directly answered you and gave you what you wanted.
Guys, as well as featuring mutants who were also in Frontier in Space. I mean, yes,
that's right.
We've got some wild connections to talk about.
We do. And by the way, if you're here just for our commentary on the mutants and you want to cut right to that, feel free to check the show notes in your podcast app or the notes right under the video if you're watching us on YouTube or Spotify, and check for the time code, which will be there very prominently in the right after the description. You can cut right to that and get.
Yeah, if you are dying of radiation poisoning, then please skip forward, and you know we'll discuss the cure. We'll talk crystals, and you can get straight to that. Usually starts about 10 minutes in. If you never look at the show notes, we're trying to roughly do that with the feedback loop. A lot of interesting stuff going on in the feedback loop, including the Homerji challenge, which is coming up. But in the meantime, we'd just like to remind you folks that one of the best ways to show that you like Pull to Open is to leave a review in the podcast app you're using, especially Apple Podcasts, if you happen to be using that. I know I do occasionally. But if you're in there, just leave a review. Five-star reviews are fun. You feel really good about yourself when you leave a 5-star review for a podcast. You're going to get that warm radioactive glow with you all day. But there's a better way to share this podcast and its very random discussion of Doctor Who. Is share it with a friend. Don't just review it, share it with a friend. Send it, hit that share button on your smartphone, and just like the first 4 or 5 people that pop up, just share the podcast with them. No explanation.
Just do it.
Yeah, just do it. Be random.
Tweet it out. Tweet it to your followers. You can do that.
Tweet it to your followers. You can follow us on all of the socials. We will get to that. And one thing that you can do on all of the socials, in all of your reviews, is choose a Doctor Who story that you like, represent it in emoji form, and that will form a direct pipeline to Pete torturing my brain, as he is about to now, with what we like to call the Whomoji Charge.
Oh, it's my favorite segment. It's happening now. Yep. Where I get to tease the brain of one Chris Taylor on Doctor Who show titles and what their emoji form is. So I got one here. We got a bunch in recently. Okay. Oh boy. And this one, this is an interesting one. I think you'll like it. So I don't know if you'll get it, but I think you'll like it.
I certainly won't get it. Set expectations low.
So are you ready, sir?
No, but let's do it anyway.
All right. Commencing the emoji challenge. This is from Gabriel Canada. He comments on a lot of our YouTube videos. Thank you, Gabriel. And he gave us a couple of these. And I'm going to give you the shorter one right now. So this is 2 emojis. And spoiler, they're the same emoji. So here it is.
Oh, no. Okay.
First emoji, devil face with horns.
Okay.
And second emoji, also devil face with horns.
Is it the sea devils? Because we're seeing devils.
Good guess, but wrong.
No. It's the Satan pit, because you've got 2 Satans there.
I think there was only 1 Satan in the Satan pit.
It's a whole pit of Satans.
That's the Big Finish secret.
The second Satan.
The Satan pool, that one.
Yeah. The Satan pool. No, oh God. Is there a devil? Is there just the devil's title in all of Doctor Who?
You're getting warm. You're getting warm.
Oh, really? The demons.
Boom. Exactly.
There we go. Thank goodness we were in the Pertwee era, and my brain was sort of in that realm anyway.
Is it the demons or the daemons? I'm always...
Daemons. I don't know.
I think it's the... I think they pronounce it the daemons, like, in the actual show, but I think it's actually, like, you just pronounce it normally, like demons. I think that's how you're supposed to say the word.
I'm going to split the difference and say daemons, which is how I always think of it when I spell it that way. Daemons! Daemons!
Beautiful! That was good. That was a good exercise in process of elimination. Nicely done, sir.
Yes. Thank you,
Gabriel, for that Whomoji challenge. And we'll get to the other one and some others that we also got in from various folks in the coming weeks.
Oh, wow. You guys like to torture me. I love it. Bring it on.
All right. Speaking of bringing it on, guys, keep bringing it on Spotify. Hey, Spotify listeners, we're talking to you now. Not only can you rate this show, Pull to Open, on your mobile app, you can give a rating for the Doctor Who stories that we talk about. So as fans know, we give a rating for the story we're talking about at the end of every episode of Pull to Open. There's the Dalek, the Ogron, the Viscount Banger. We'll explain all those at the end of the show. But you too have a voice on Spotify, and something we're going to be calling Poll to Open, because you use the poll feature on Spotify to basically vote. And we keep these polls open for as long as we can, which is quite a while. So if you're finding this podcast in the future and you think, oh, I missed the boat on voting on mutants or whatever, no, you have it. Go ahead. Go to your the poll feature in the show and go ahead and have your vote. And then we will talk about the results.
Vote early, vote late, vote often, whatever you like. And we got results for the Ark in Space.
We do?
Which is an interesting one because, as we noted at the time, both returning showrunner RTD and Stephen Moffat rated this their favorite Classic Who episode ever. So presumably would have called it a Viscount banger. But only 10% of our audience agreed with them.
I know.
And yes, 80% of them agreed with us when we rated it a Dalek.
Very solid solid showing on the Dalek, but still a Dalek. Not a banger.
Not a banger, and 10% said Professor Hayter, which is our rating for not a great episode, but taught us something, or they tried something, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I sort of want people to kind of leave their comments there at the end as well, like, what exactly is it you think they tried for the first time? Is it the human colonization aspect? Because I feel like all of the elements in Ark and Space were done before, but yeah, they didn't like it, but at least they didn't think it was an ogre. No.
Yeah, exactly. I could see that. I could see that. They definitely tried to make it more adult. So maybe that's what they were sort of voting for, because it was famously the first story produced by Philip Hinchcliffe. They also tried some bugs. So that's always fun.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, the Hinchcliffe thing. That makes sense. All right. Yeah. No Ogrons, no fixed points in time. Looking forward to the results from the Frontier in Space. See how many Ogrons we get for that, for the most Ogron-stuffed story. If you're an Ogron, please fire up Ogron Spotify and vote Ogron.
Yeah, do not feel obligated to give it an Ogron just because there are Ogrons in it, though. I feel I should emphasize that. It might get a poor showing for the Frontier in Space, but you might have to disqualify some of those Ogron votes if it tends to dominate the ratings. So we'll see.
Yes, and if you're a Dalek, also feel free to vote a Dalek.
All right.
But do so very late in the day, at the very last minute, as a surprise.
Well, if you are a Spotify listener, you might also want to check us out on another platform, that being YouTube. So we're at youtube.com/boltopen. Now, even though you can see us on Spotify, because we're on Spotify video podcasts, we are also on YouTube, and it is a great thing to subscribe to us there as well, because that will also really help the show. So, plus, obviously, you can see all of the Easter eggs in our background. There's also a way to get notifications whenever we have new content. So all of that's great. And special bonus, we are now also on YouTube Music. So if you listen to YouTube Music, if you subscribe to that, you should be able to easily find us. Just search for Pull to Open, and we will pop up on the podcasts tab or whatever that is in the search results on YouTube Music. And you can subscribe to us there, too. So that's good times.
That's exciting.
Lots of really good discussion on YouTube, too. We have lots of good comments. And I'd like to highlight one of those now. And it's from one of our fans there on YouTube. It's Nat Smith. And they're commenting on our podcast for Frontier in Space. Mm-hmm. And he made me aware of something that I don't think I might have been aware of once and just kind of forgot about. But anyway, here's the comment. It says, maybe this would be more relevant for when you all get to the story, but I love the fact that it's nearly universally agreed upon that the reason the Daleks executed the Master in the opening of the TV movie was for letting the Doctor escape in the last moments of this story, thus defeating their efforts on Spyridon, which is the planet of the Daleks in the following story. I just enjoy that this is the kind of show where plot points can have ramifications 20-ish years later down the line, even if it's a bit of a retcon. Plus, it gives me the headcanon that the Master has such a long list of beings that they need to avoid because of betrayal and other failures throughout the years that they lost track, which I think this is pretty good. Actually, I sort of vaguely remember, I think, hearing this theory, I think, in the 90s sometime, and then kind of forgot about it. But it totally makes sense. Like, this is 100%, yeah, because the TV movie opens up, the Daleks are executing the Master for some reason. You're just like, what? Did I just come in the middle of something here? Which you kind of are in the TV movie, but it is that actually makes total sense. This is like sort of their revenge for utterly screwing up the end of that story. Now, on top of that, I kind of wonder, like, what would have they just gone past a certain statute of limitations by the time of the power of the Doctor, I guess, when they're all kind of working together. But I mean, I feel like because the Dalek Empire is destroyed and rebooted a few times between now and then, I think it's kind of like, okay, that's a bit of a reset.
Yeah, the Master manages to make peace with the Daleks by introducing them to the music of Boney M. which I don't know if you watch Black Mirror. Rasputin got its second pop culture outing of the year in that the last Black Mirror episode, Demon 79, they actually feature a demon in the form of a member of Boney M in story. Which is fabulous, given that, of course, The Power of the Doctor really just had us all singing Rasputin in our heads. But yeah, I love this. I love this comment. Nat's absolutely right. I think, however, that we're not thinking big enough here. Like, if we're going to headcanon this stuff, let's tie it all into the Time War, right? Because Daleks, the Time War, at the time of the TV movie, the Time War is almost upon us, right? It's
right.
It's going to hit soon at the end of the McGann era. The Daleks executing the Master could be a thing that the Time Lords would take as a provocation, right? Hey, hang on, he's our renegade. We're the ones who get to execute him. These Daleks are a menace. Maybe that's when they go back and tell the Tom Baker Doctor in Genesis of the Daleks to eradicate them in the beginning, and then that kicks off the whole conflict. We're really thinking Time War hit. Like, Frontier in Space gave us a reason to think about it. We're going to talk about the Time Lord involvement here at the Mutants. Certainly something the Randomizer wants to think about. And I would just love to see a nice long essay on, like, tying almost everything of the loose plot threads of Doctor Who into the Time War. Can it be done?
Yeah, because there's definitely, like, a couple of dimensions to the beginning of the TV movie. One is the stuff we just talked about with the Master being executed by the Daleks, but another is that the Doctor is explicitly transporting his remains back home. And that's another one where you're like, well, what, why, you know, and who put him up to that? And some of that is actually kind of answered in the novelization, but the novelization's canonicity is obviously questionable. So there's another sort of thing to unpack there. And if it is sort of the Time Lords doing this mission, basically getting the Doctor to do it on behalf of them, I like your theory that could be some provocation, that they're getting the evidence, I guess, to make maybe some case to the Lord President or whatever to escalate this to some kind of time war. That's not bad.
Yeah. Especially as the Doctor kind of snitches on the Master at the end of Frontier in Space and asks for directions to the pirate planet and the planet of the Daleks, which I guess, spoiler alert, is Spyridon.
That's not much of a spoiler. You just learned the name of it. But I already spoiled that it wasn't Skaro, so.
Yes. So, yeah, definitely something. There's a whole other Doctor Who to be filmed, as it were, about the machinations of the Time Lords in the background of all of these stories. So,
yeah.
Opening my head canon up to that. Thank you, Nat. Thank you for everyone commenting.
And if you would like to give us the script to that that idea, go ahead and send it to us on TikTok.
Yeah.
Pull to open in the video form. We're pull to open, all one word. Or just drop us a line on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. On all of those platforms, we are at Pull2Open63. So go ahead and drop us a line.
All right. And it's finally time to talk about the Time War ad nauseam, because that's how we pick off.
That's what the Mutants is all about, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah. I'd like to start a half-hour audio essay on the subject of the Mutants and the Time War.
Time War.
Like a great way to start off our recap, right, Pete?
Time War didn't watch. No. TWDW?
Hey.
No, guys, it is time for TLDW. Too Long Didn't Watch. Too Long Doctor Who, where we summarize the entire plot of a Doctor Who story in record time. And today, the person doing it has a whole 3 minutes, because this is six full episodes of the classic series, for which we allot 30 seconds per episode. And the person to take advantage of all of that time is one Chris Taylor. Are you ready, sir? Second time I've asked that of you today.
I think I need to beam down to Solos first and do some more research. Guys, okay. You just talk amongst yourselves for the next half hour. I'll go check this out again. All right.
It's been a colony for 500 years, so they have some time. No, but we should get to this quickly before those missiles hit. All right. I'm going to assume you're ready. I'm going to start the countdown to the official pull to open summary of The Mutants in 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so we start on the planet of Solace, and there's an old guy coming out of the mist, and it's not Monty Python, it's the mutants, because the Marshal and Stubbs and Cotton are chasing him, and they shoot him, and the Marshal is some guy who's like, he's a mutt, and Stubbs and Cotton are like, God, this planet can't get independence fast enough. Cut to the Doctor and Joe in their lab, and they've just received something has appeared, and Joe is like, is this lunch? Is it a bomb? No, it's a message from the Time Lords, but the Doctor can't open it. He has to get into the TARDIS and go to this Skybase 1, which is in orbit around Solace, and there's a peace conference going on there between the people on the planet and the Overlords, which is the future human empire, and the Doctor's like, hey, can someone open this? Turns out to be this guy named Kai can open the special message from the Time Lords. But what happens? Oh, the administrator of the station has just been assassinated by the Solace people, and there's panic, and the Marshal is taken over. It's martial law. And the Doctor and Joe and Stubbs and Cotton all running around, and eventually they go down to the caves on Solace, and the Marshal's trying to bomb them out with Professor Jaeger, who's basically a Nazi doctor, and but the Doctor survives in the caves, and they encounter these really mutated versions of the Solace people, and but they also find this professor who's been down there for ages, who saves them from the radiation, and brings them to his special lair, and he used to be with the Overlords as well. He and the Doctor and Joe, they all find that they find this crystal, which they do some experimentation on. They manage to open the package from the Time Lords, and they see that it's all like little hieroglyphs of explaining that Solace has actually got like a 500-year going on, and they're changing seasons, and these things aren't mutations. It's a natural life cycle that always happens on Solace, like a butterfly kind of thing going on. So, but meanwhile, the Marshal is mad. He wants to totally turn the atmosphere into Earth air, and he keeps bombarding the planet with it, but they're all beamed back up, and there's a rebellion and a revolt, and the Marshal accidentally shoots a hole in Skybase 1, and a bunch of people get sucked out into space, but eventually the Earth investigators arrive, and Joe tells them everything about what's been going on. The Doctor sort of is worried about Joe, so he doesn't tell the investigators everything, but eventually he does, and then the Marshal ends up getting killed by Kai, who's mutated into his super form, and then the Doctor and Joe go back into the broom cupboard and back into the TARDIS while telling very bad jokes. And what else is going on? Oh, Cotton elects to remain behind with this
and
professor.
Time.
So, oh,
cool. Yeah.
Yes,
you got cool. You got it, but and then you didn't with the filler. Good job.
Thank you. I figured get to the end as fast as possible, and then I can go back and use the extra seconds. This is my new.
Well, I was worried. This happens a lot, actually, I think, when you're basically exhausted your first 30 seconds, so ostensibly the first episode, and you're about 5 minutes in. Yes. You did a lot of, like, the first couple of scenes in your TLDW.
Yes. Yeah. Well, with Frontier Space last week, we noted there was a lot of prison scenes. You can kind of conflate them a lot. Here, there's just a lot of going back and forth between Solace and the Skybase, right?
Right, and into the caves, and don't really see much of Solace other than the caves, and like a couple of shots. There's a couple of shots of the village, and a couple of shots of bushes that people crouch under. I mean, I guess in that first scene when they're chasing the old guy.
Yeah, but no women. Strangely enough, that's one thing I notice. There are no women on Solace. How do they? I mean, do they reproduce asexually? What is going on?
Feel like you needed Sarah Jane there to talk about not just women's lib coming to Solace, but women.
Liberate the women from the underground caves in which you're keeping them, people.
Yeah. Jesus. So taking a step back, The Mutants is one, the second story to be called The Mutants in Doctor Who.
Yes.
Which is kind of a funny thing because it used to be that the second serial, which is now known as the Daleks generally, was called The Mutants for a long time, or at least that sort of used both names. And then after this was broadcast, they stopped calling it The Mutants. more or less. And I don't, you have to go way back on some old material to really find it referred to that way.
But can this be rewritten.
You know, it's a pretty, this is also the second story written by Bob Bob Baker and Dave Martin?
Baker and Martin. They're just the Baker and Martin team. We've seen their stuff before with the Claws of Axos.
Yeah. They're very prolific. Yeah. They wrote a lot of stories together. I think when you got a team, I guess you can really crank these out. This is a very overtly political, story. And definitely sort of highlighting the evils of colonization and sort of the racism that gets associated with that. It kind of hits you over the head with it, but I think, you know, you get it, like, and it doesn't do it in such a way like Orphan 55 does, where it's super preachy. I think this is simply a future portrayal of this kind of idea. And there are a couple things that are super obvious. Like the biggest one is that the main set with the transmat has the arrows of here's where the overlords go. And here's where the Solonians go. And, you know, it's one of those things. Why would they even need separate transmats? And it's not supposed to be logical, right? It's the whole point. Yeah. It's like, you don't need separate water fountains as well, separate schools or et cetera. So
probably the most overtly political moment where I think that the Doctor and Joe kind of look at it and he literally said segregation as he looks at that. It's on the political front. It was trying to pack a little too much in. Now I'm definitely a fan of narratives that tackle politics from a remove. Star Trek did it a lot in the 60s, obviously, famously. But here there were just kind of too many cooks in the political kitchen, as it were. So Baker and Martin really wanted to do something about South Africa and segregation. Terrence Dix, who we last encountered when we were at the War Games, when he wanted to say something about war. By the way, we were with his co-writer Malcolm Hulk last week in The Frontier in Space, another randomizer connection.
Dix was script editor at this time.
He was script editor, and he wanted to do something more focused on British colonialism and decolonization. Mm. And this is definitely a period, this is 1971, 72 when
72 sounds right.
72, yes. So this is a period where all of a sudden, and we talked about this with Carnival of Monsters, all of a sudden British TV is full of programs that are re-examining the British Empire and sort of saying, oops. Sorry, I didn't realize we did that. So, you know, Britain's kind of coming to terms with itself in the early 70s. And meanwhile, Barry Letts had this idea for a species that kind of evolves like a butterfly. It's actually a very original idea. I couldn't find any previous example of that in science fiction history. That's kind of new. It kind of feels a bit Game of Thrones, doesn't it? With the idea of the seasons being hundreds of years long.
Yeah. I mean, confess, I've actually never gotten into Game of Thrones, and that might be something that I've just made all pulled to open listeners go, what? I have never really gotten into it.
It's not really explained in Game of Thrones. It's just kind of taken as a point of fact in the world that, you know, winter will last for, we don't know how long, 10 years, 12 years, whatever, like it's going to be a serious winter. And then there's spring and summer, et cetera. So
you definitely get a sense of, like, you would definitely be more surprised by those ideas from something in 1972. And I think you're right. I'm trying to sort of, as you were asking, had anything done this? My quick Rolodex of the Star Trek, the original Star Trek, I can't really, there might be something in there. No, nothing really comes to mind. Mm. I do know in later Star Treks, they do these kinds of things. And there was definitely sort of a famous or infamous episode in the first season of Star Trek Enterprise that talked about a race that is going to go in some sort of natural evolutionary process. And this is what sort of begets the Prime Directive.
Interesting.
But that's the only clear example of that. And there's probably something in Next Generation just because it went seven seasons and they did every possible plot, I think.
So it's a bit too much. It's almost, like something we often accuse Stephen Moffat of, is kind of packing too many concepts into one story. And that's definitely what's going on here. Like all of those things, segregation, colonialism, the butterfly evolution, these could all have been separate stories.
Well, they were also going to include a little bit on cloning towards the end for whatever reason. And that, you know, they rightly decided, let's not do that because it would make it too complicated. And they ended up, it's funny, they ended up doing something like that in The Invisible Enemy, where they kind of just throw in cloning so they can go into, he can go into his own brain and stuff like that, which sort of seems like a funny semi-extraneous thing. So Doctor Who even got around to doing the extra ideas that they had. In various episodes.
Recycle your ideas. Star Wars famous for doing that. The Dix and Letts, they also added Professor Jaeger, who's sort of the, as I described him, as a Nazi doctor in the TLDW. He is, basically, because he's, you know, he may be a well-meaning scientist, but like he's chemically bombarding this planet.
Yeah, and he's complicit, I think is a good word for him. So, yeah, it's a good place to start, honestly, talking about him and his relation to the Marshal and how he contrasts with two of the guards, Stubbs and Cotton, who, because it's I think it's important to sort of draw these lines, and because this is the story invites us to do it, because the Marshal is one of the evil, most honestly, one of the most evil characters I think we've seen in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And we can get to him in a bit. Stubbs and Cotton are kind of these guys who don't really like what they're doing, but they're kind of almost the just obeying orders type until the Doctor shows up and things start to really go bad. And they're kind of forced to make a choice. And they choose to start working against the Marshal, which is good for them. Yeah. Whereas Jaeger,
Stubbs and Cotton,
Jaeger doesn't. Right? He clearly makes the choice to stay with the Marshal and his plan, regardless whether that's reluctantly, and it probably is a bit reluctantly. I mean, I think you can tell from the script. And there's even a moment in episode 6 where the Marshal, basically, I think he's talking about how he's putting the people back in the room where all the radiation is coming in. And he says like, well, the radiation is going to be, they'll die. And he's like, yeah, that's the whole point. And Jaeger's, he's sort of taken aback. He's kind of horrified just by the casual cruelty and evil of this guy. And he sort of goes, but he doesn't do anything. He's just kind of like, oh, okay, I guess that's what we're doing, you know? And that's kind of like what he does throughout, like with the missiles, and he's changing the atmosphere. And he sort of makes up these reasons to justify it to himself. He's like, Earth's dying, and, you know, we need this colony. And the Doctor has a really great retort at one point to him, which is like, genocide is a side effect. Yeah, we can't worry about side effects. It's like, genocide is a side effect. Wow. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, think about what you're doing. But of course, even if he does think about what he's doing, he never reverses course. He never changes his mind or switches sides. So I think it's totally fair to call him essentially a Nazi doctor, which is, even though he's not the psycho, he's not the guy literally taking the skin and making lamps out of it or whatever, you know, horrors you want to pick from the Nazi time. But he is sort of like not actively working against this horrible thing that's happening. And it's harsh judgment, I'll admit, but it is what it is, you know, like, and again, we have to sort of take the script on its face value here. Jaeger, man. Mm. He's not that much of a redeeming character.
He's the Jaeger bomb. I just wish that all of these things had room to breathe, right? You know, because they kind of just all come together.
We had 6 episodes.
I know. You'd think, but so much of it is taken up with running around caves. And, like little scenes back on the station and just, and also we should say, just while we're at this 30,000 feet view, some of the worst acting ever.
There's some bad stuff. Who are you thinking of specifically? I've got my picks on this one.
Well, I would say the Marshal is not.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I actually didn't mind him. But anyway, go on.
We'll get to Cotton. Like, Cotton's kind of an obvious one, but but the marshal, the guy's playing the marshal, just sort of doesn't really seem to be having fun with it. Like he's this Hermann Göring figure. He's a total fascist. He's got the totally fascist uniform with the helmet, and he just, you know, he wants to terraform the planet, and he wants to recolonize it, basically. But like the actor, he almost plays him a bit understated, which is weird. Like when everyone else is kind of overacting, he's underacting. Whereas this is the role where you exaggerate and kind of have fun with it, right? If you're gonna do this at all, and yet it's just sort of like he's just like the not fun boss. He's just so shouty and just so kind of single-minded. Like there's nothing to him. There's nothing compelling to him. You don't get any sense of layers.
Yeah, there definitely isn't layers to him. I mean, he's not conflicted at all. But that's actually honestly why I find him a good character, but I like seeing this brand of evil on display. You could make a case either way on the acting. I thought honestly, it's weird. I saw this when I was a kid. I only seen this one other time when I sort of was first watching Pertwee, and or maybe the second time. I think I actually saw the omnibus version. So I remember when I said I sort of checked out of Pertwee on the initial run. I think it was right around here, and it might have been even like the first couple episodes of The Mutants that had me check out. But I was young. I was like 10 or 11, and a lot of the political stuff would have gone over my head.
Right.
And when I watched this now, because I definitely saw it one more time, probably when I was 13, not certainly much more politically aware. But now seeing it again 30 plus years later, I was actually surprised how much I was taken in by the politics. I'm just like, oh, I get it. This is an anti-colonial message. And then seeing a guy like the Marshal, this person, again, you're not wrong. I mean, there's no depth to him. But seeing that sort of brand of evil of like, this is what I'm doing, and I'm just going to do it by any means necessary, and I have zero empathy and zero thought for anyone around, and it's sort of a casual cruelty. Like, it's very goal based. You know, I got to get this, and I'll kill as many people, or just not really kill. He's not relishing the killing so much as just like they're in my way. Like, why wouldn't I kill them?
He has zero political instinct as well. Like he locks up one of the investigators at the end when he has, there's absolutely no reason to. Like he'd kind of fooled the investigators into thinking in his way of thinking and releasing his men.
He hadn't, but I got to say, that's one of there's a lot of plot weaknesses here, but one of them is that if the investigator, I don't want to just kind of get a little bit on a tangent from the marshal, but it makes no sense that he would just give power to the marshal right then, because the guy's under investigation and the things he's been accused of are extremely serious. I get that he's under the impression there's an emergency, but giving supreme authority to the guy who has just been accused of abusing that authority, surely there was another thing you could have done, given figured out who's the second in command here or what have you, or give it to one of your own men, etc. You didn't have to give authority to the marshal to get that done. Now, you're right about the political instinct stuff, but I also think you kind of have to headcanon. There's not even that much headcanon, because I think they do paint a pretty clear picture that Solas is sort of on the back of Beyond. It's like the contact with Earth has been extremely minimal. It's obviously a long journey to get there. So they're kind of on their own. This is kind of like, you know, the frontier. This is way out. But he doesn't really have to answer to anybody in a real sense, right? And he can sort of plan around other people coming to investigate, particularly if he's got a thriving colony by the time they get there. So I think it's not that I'll admit he's probably not thought it all through, because he is kind of a madman. The doctor's not wrong about that either. But it's not as like totally insane as I think it sometimes comes across.
Yeah, the investigator giving his man and his power back. Could you imagine that, American voters? Imagine giving the power to run everything back to the guy who's under investigation. Sorry, a little bit of politics, a little bit of politics.
Throw
that in there. But yeah, so to get back to the casting of the Marshal, I would have loved, so Jeffrey frickin' Palmer is in this. He's the guy who plays the administrator, who is the cool guy who wants to, you know, give solace back to the Salonians and get the hell out of there, go back home, you know, decolonize. And he's the one who gets assassinated. Now, Jeffrey Palmer, British people know him from just everything. He's such an amazing actor. He's been in Doctor Who two other times. He was, I believe, the captain of the Titanic in Voyage of the Damned.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now that he definitely looked familiar. Okay. Yep. Makes sense.
I think Wheel in Space is the other one, but he's just in everything. And he is the finest actor in this. So to assassinate him at the end of episode one, very poor choice. I would actually have loved to have seen him as the Marshal, because then he would have brought some depth to the character, I think, and made it much more interesting, given how much we have to focus on him. Like, I think a thing that obviously this is hindsight. What we know now from the golden age of television is anti-heroes are potentially the most interesting people in a multi-episode TV story. And so I would love to see Jeffrey Palmer in, if you will, kind of a Walter White role here of, like, you know, being the bad guy, but maybe he has other reasons. Now,
obviously
this would have necessitated a bit of a different script anyway, but he could have injected it with some layers, some depth.
Yeah, I think that's what's lacking here, even though I think it's spelled out what their plan is, which is what's the Marshal's plan, but Jaeger sort of adopts it too, in that they want to essentially create new Earth. And Earth is in a sorry state. They paint a pretty vivid picture of a place that is completely urbanized. It's essentially Blade Runner Earth. But worse, because there's a point where Kai talks about, oh, you must come from a sky city. And Joe's all like, no, I'm from London. It's like on the ground. And he's like, no. I've heard about Earth. Like everything is like completely crappy. No one lives on the ground anymore. Which is like, oh, that's a grim picture of Earth. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the Empire's in decline, and I think it's really interesting that Doctor Who, probably because of the sort of anti-colonial stuff that was going on at the time, decided to show an Empire in decline and what was going on there. And before, it actually showed the beginnings of it, right, in Frontier in Space. So it's funny, the randomizer sort of taking us in reverse order of this, sort of in the kind of the proper order as far as the chronology goes.
Randomizing not being random.
But they paint that picture of Earth, and they want to create this new Earth and essentially create a new center of the Empire, because they have dreams of creating a new Empire, and that they feel like it starts here. And despite the fact that the atmosphere is poisonous and whatever, and the Marshal has ways to deal with that, obviously with the missiles and stuff, but they're just pulling out. Which is clearly the right thing to do. I mean, it seems like they've really ruined this planet in a lot of ways, and
the
people don't like
all
them.
Of the, what is the resource that they're extracting here?
Some kind of radioactive. It's like thiesium, some made up radioactive element.
Some mineral MacGuffin, if you will.
There always is.
Yeah, that they have extracted for the
planet. They did this a lot in the Pertwee era with Peladon and stuff. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. But it definitely gets that connection between, you know, colonialism and the extraction of resources, right?
So yes.
Kind of really adult history stuff here being inserted into a kid's show. It's fascinating. You know, definitely you can't fault them for their ambition on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perhaps too much stuff trapped in. But to go back to the casting, I think it is time to tackle the problem of Rick James, who is the guy who plays Cotton, and is an actor from Antigua. And I believe the director really fought to get a black actor into this production. And I'm glad he did, because it's obviously, you know, it's dealing with issues of segregation. And you call it let's get a bit of diversity in there as well. Now, Rick James, who plays Cotton, he's kind of derided by a lot of Doctor Who fans for being a terrible actor in this. And you've got to admit, it is not his finest hour. And part of the problem is, Baker and Martin were very surprised that he was cast. as an Antiguan actor, because they'd written this part for a Cockney. Like, they'd written all of the dialogue for a Cockney. Stubbs is clearly from Liverpool. He's a Scouser. And, you know, Cotton was going to be a Cockney. So,
yeah, he even calls him, like, Stubbsy at one point. And it seems like a weird choice almost.
We've done a lot better in Cockney. Stubbsy.
Yeah.
But no, he's doing his Antiguan accent. And he kind of stumbles over the lines a lot, and it just kind of looks like he's in an amateur theatre production, which is very unfortunate, again, given that he's, you know, kind of flying the flag for diversity and representation in Doctor Who. But he is, so I did a little bit of research on him, he's Rick James, bitch. He's was an actor of stage and screen. He actually came here to San Francisco and studied acting in L.A. and went on the stage in London. He was turned down for a bit. He turned down a Bond movie.
Oh, wow.
Which he was probably going to have a bit part. I think it was in Live or Let Die. Live or Let Die.
Oh, yeah.
I've
never seen that one.
Yeah, and then he marries this German woman. He goes back to Antigua, and he becomes this political activist for, like, you know, Antiguan elections. He wants to kind of remove the corruption from the Antiguan political system. So, you know, good on you, Rick James.
Is he still around?
He died in 2018, I believe.
Ah, okay. R.I.P. Rick James.
He had a long, long, rich life, married a German woman. They had a son together. He had quite a life. So it is unfortunate that this is the only intersection that it had with Doctor Who, because I kind of wanted him to you know, go back and prove that he's a better actor than he appears to be here.
Well, at least his character survives.
Yes, it does, which is interesting that Stubbs is the one that dies, because too often we have this trope of, like, you know, the black friend dies, is kind of a trope in a lot of writing, and they kind of reverse that here, which is interesting. But yeah, it's sad to see Stubbs go as well. You know, I'm always looking for more Liverpool representation in Doctor Who.
Well, I like that the pair of them are granted more depth than your average guard, and they follow the Doctor and Joe around, particularly in the caves, and are pretty instrumental to sort of helping them out in this story. So that's all good. I feel like the cave stuff bears a little unpacking. First of all, the caves look amazing. Those are real caves, for sure.
Real caves.
They're some of the best caves Doctor Who has shot in, I think. They actually kind of reminded me. I'm not sure. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but they look very similar, I think, to some of the caves in The Five Doctors. I think it's a different location, but Doctor Who's had some good caves, and this is some of the better ones.
Of the better ones, but it was so... I just read an interview with a designer on this, who said some things that were like, you could never do that today. He said that we just smeared wallpaper paste and glitter on the walls of the caves. Which is like, really? Were you concerned about that? They look fabulous, that's why. But he also said they looked like they were going to fall down, which is like... You know, you wouldn't.
Right.
You just wouldn't shoot there these days if caves. There were chalk caves. Those bits coming off, and it's like, yeah, none of this would be replicated in the 21st century.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Some health and safety concerns would probably get brought up today.
Health and safety nightmare.
But they're good caves up until the point where they have to do some like CSO type effects work, and essentially Joe and the Doctor at some point have to go in sort of the rave cave or the disco cave, where
the rave cave, the rainbow rave cave. It is so appropriate that we are recording this on Pride weekend here in the Bay Area, because yes, this is a rainbow filled episode, my friends. This is Doctor Who being out and proud and loud. My goodness. I really like, that was actually my favorite part, was the visuals in the caves. My favorite part of the mutants, and it's almost like that parts of this are like a music video in embryo. Yeah. You know, like that may be the best part of way to see these episodes.
It's better when it is the actual caves, because when it's clearly like an actor and superimposed over some glowing sort of still picture of a cave, that's not good. But when they're actually in the caves and they actually have some green lights and some yellow lights or blue light, whatever it is. That looks pretty good. That looks like, oh, that's a party I want to go to. That's awesome. Because it's got John Pertwee and Katie Manning and we're all hanging out in the caves with these crazy bug-like guys who are kind of dancing like crazy and swinging their hands and their claws around.
The mandibles. I love the mutant costumes. They're fabulous.
Well, and speaking of underused, I feel like they're really underused. I mean, they don't really do much. You know, they kind of sort of attack the Joe and Kai early on, and then they're shooed away. And then they kind of just leave everybody alone for a long time and until Professor Sondergaard brings them all up to the base, or others brings at least one of them up to the base, but he could like gathers a bunch of mutants, and you think there's going to be a big mutant down at the OK Corral here on Skybase, but no, like just one of them comes up and just gets shot.
Yes. So much for the mutant mutiny. again, it's sort of an interesting time to be recording this because we have just had that very weird mutiny in Russia. Which sort of feels like it, like I was watching this in the wake of that, and it kind of feels like it ties in to a certain respect. Like, yes, the mutants do stage this very weird insurrection. So do the Salonians who were in original form. Like, is it Varen? Good. Who sort Varen. Of kind of limply waves a sword at the marshal, and then gets sucked into space.
Well, funny. We were just talking about in Frontier in Space about sort of the rushed ending and the bad it cuts and it doesn't really work as an action sequence last week. Here, holy cow! Like that is a master class. Like that's like John Woo level action compared to some of the stuff here. Like you talked about Varen waving his sword and that whole scene where the marshal opens fire on him, it blows a hole in the bulkhead and they're going to get sucked down into space. And first of all, like I'll forgive the bad effects. It's Doctor Who. But the whole thing where they're kind of trying to climb out and grab onto things and get out of there. And it's just so bad. They just kind of walk out. Like there's no, I don't think anyone even turned on a fan. You know, like what are you doing? Like it just looks really, really bad. And then it also just makes no sense, right? Like if the air's all sucked out, like you're just you're gonna survive for a minute. Well, not even a minute, like a few seconds, and then you're just gonna fall down. Luckily, like they get this right years later in Oxygen and in various other places. But It's just a weird to think about the genesis of that scene where the marshal just shoots his gun and destroys the wall. If you think about it, it's like, if the walls are that flimsy, there should be complete forbidden firearms in this place. Like everyone should be checking their gun. Like there should be no guns allowed on Skybase whatsoever. If that there's even a chance of that happening.
Yeah. And you would expect just a tiny bullet hole, but no. This whole the size of a Greek column. I mean, it's just wow. No wonder they get instantly sucked out. And yeah, the weapons do not seem to be that effective otherwise. So it's very bizarre. Again, maybe carbon fiber walls. Again, a little bit of topicality with the carbon fiber submarine that just went down the wreck of the Titanic. So fascinating stuff. The mutants kind of work. It's kind of hilarious. This is definitely one of the more campy episodes of Doctor Who. And kind of weird stuff kind of going on during the filming as well. Did you know that Jon Pertwee adopted a pet field mouse on the shooting of this?
I didn't. Seems like the kind of thing he would do, though. He's either stealing stuff from the ancient ships or... He's adopting, having conversations with draconians or adopting mice. It's kind of his thing.
Katie Manning did a photo shoot with a llama. I mean, this was early 70s groovy Doctor Who, baby, with, you know, lots of right on politics and cool, colorful caves and rave caves and the costumes. I really like Joe's costume.
I
like that.
Joe's great.
Badass stuff there. And to your point last week, we hoped that Joe would have the file in her shoe rather than the doctor to get her to prison. She produces the sonic screwdriver at the end. She had it.
Yeah.
Which again connects us to the fact that the Sonic Screwdriver was lost in Frontier Space.
Yeah, I gotta say it's a decent episode for Joe, and one of the better cliffhanger. I was just tearing apart the episode 4 cliffhanger, but the episode 5 cliffhanger, which again has one of those bad Cotton lines where he's like, "We're done for," and it really like that should have been a Cockney accent there for sure.
We're done for.
Yeah,
we're gone.
But I do like that she doesn't need to be rescued by the Doctor. That they figure out how to get out of there without dying. And it's not Joe on her own, but like they kind of get out, and that's pretty good. So there's a little bit earlier on, which doesn't make a ton of sense to me, but she does get the story going by going with Kai at the beginning of episode 2. But she seems very determined to go with him, even though Kai's just explained, you're going to be poisoned, you understand, like that you can't breathe the atmosphere. I mean, you can only breathe it for like an hour and you're gonna be dead. Like, you should not want to come with me, yet she insists on going with him, which is like, why are you, he just kidnapped you, number one. And I get that you're sort of I think she saw the thing open, right, the thing they brought when he walked by. So I think she's latched onto that idea, like, this guy's the guy we're looking for, I have to stay with him. But she's kind of taking it to a crazy extreme.
Does Joe just really want a boyfriend there badly? Because like, it's, obviously we've been to the Green Death. We see that she does eventually leave the Doctor for the first really cute guy to come along. Maybe she saw that in Kai too. Kai,
she's a year in. She's a year into traveling with the Doctor. She's like, probably getting a little hard up here.
Yeah. Speaking of Kai, who's kind of, again, kind of a weak role, unfortunately.
Speaking of shouty.
He has Kai and Varen. They both just sort of, they shout a lot and interrupt people a lot. And you can get it. They're angry. Their planet's been colonized. But like maybe some variation of emotion. I don't know. Maybe during the seasons they only have one emotion. They only have the shouty season, and then they turn into butterflies. So Kai, originally the idea was, so they find this crystal in the caves, and they in the original script they turn the crystal into a serum. They inject the serum into Kai. He becomes literally, and it is called this in the script, Super Kai. So instead of being this kind of floaty rainbow colored, again, very 70s, very Earth, Wind and Fire music video kind of thing that he's doing at the end there, floating around in rainbow, he like literally just becomes this super version of himself and then kills the Marshal that way.
By the way, how did you like him just killing the Marshal?
It's so nothing. It's so just, and it was a shame to find out that Barry Letts was very proud of that scene, because he was overlaying 6 different images to create it. And I think at that point, we just don't care.
Yeah.
You know, it's an example that is still well taken today in modern entertainment. Like, you can have all the special effects in the world, but if the script just, like, if you don't care about the character, it's not going to land. It's not going
to. Yeah. And I think he was so caught up in doing all the layering, he didn't focus much on what he was layering, because there's a bit like, basically, if you look at the Kai, Super Kai in the realized version, he's got this cape on. So, yeah, very Super Kai. But like, the cape is clearly on a floor, right? Like, it's longer than his feet go. And it's just sort of sitting there on, even though he's floating. So it's very obvious. I mean, I watched this with Grace, and Grace was just like, well, it's on the floor. Like, she was kind of laughing. Like, she's like, okay, doesn't look that good. But I more like on the act of just killing the Marshal, I was a little disappointed. You know, first of all, it's kind of a non moment. I mean, there's not a lot of is made of it. There's no real drama to it. And are we made to think, great, you know, like it strikes me again, for a show that is a script that is very moralistic, it seems like an act of revenge as opposed to justice. And you can make a case either way, but honestly, I would have rather seen the Doctor being the voice of that good and that justice step in, like, no, don't kill him. He has to stand trial for his crimes. Right. Like, in other words, and see him taken off at the end to the 30th century equivalent of The Hague, right? Absolutely. That would have been good. Because, you know, like, when you just murder him like that, you don't get that that closure, that full reckoning of the crimes he's done. It's just, oh, he's gone, mm-hmm. and now we're good. It's just a kind of an empty thing. And
yeah, he deserved to be bombarded ending. With radiation and poison gas. You know, make the punishment fit the crime. But yeah, it's unfortunate. Lost opportunity. I think you're absolutely right about that. Sondergaard's an interesting character, isn't he? What did you think of him? He's kind of, first of all, wow, he must have a lot of razors down there in the caves.
I was just going to say.
Well, perfect bald head.
Well, arguably, maybe he's just been not great about keeping that suit on. You know, he kind of like forgot his helmet at one point and the doctor had to remind him. So it's like, oh, so maybe that radiation is getting to him after all. Yeah, Sondergaard. I like the idea of the character. Like, it's a good dimension when he talks about how he ended up down there. He's like, I really tried to do something about this. Like, I radioed sent my messages to Earth, but the Marshall intercepted them, and I realized Solas has become a slave colony under the Marshall. Yeah. So, like, that's good. That, you know, there are. It's not new to resist him, right? Like, the people have been knowing he's been bad for a long time. It's just hard. To once he's large and in charge, to actually do something about it, particularly since he has no compunctions about getting rid of anyone who opposes him.
Sondergaard is the scientist who's gone native. By the way, he did in the original script, he spoke bits of Swedish, which is an interesting choice, but he still, I guess, got the accent. I think it would have solved a lot of problems at a stroke if he and Jaeger had some sort of relationship. Like, because they're
right. both scientists.
And they take different approaches, right? Sondergaard is the one who resisted. And Jaeger is the one who obeys orders. And having them at least mention each other, it would have been good. Would have been more of a coherent whole. Would have hung together. That'd be better as a story, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Actually, it's a really good idea.
Speaking of duos that kind of should hang together better. Stubbs and Cotton, like, it, you know, it could have been a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of situation with them. Like, you know, guards, we see so many guards. We were talking about this in the Pirate Planet, the idea of like zeroing in on a particular guard as they do in The Force Awakens, you know, and kind of just letting us see under the helmet for once. Great idea. You don't really feel them, do you? I mean, I don't think it's just Rick James struggling with the Cockney script. I don't know. They seem like they should pop more than they do.
Yeah, I feel like they're a slow roll. Like, you kind of get a couple of lines early on, but you don't really get a sense of like, oh, we're supposed to be getting to know these guys and rooting for them until around, you know, episode 2 or 3. And I feel like they should be punctuating more scenes rather than just kind of representing kind of the resistance side of things when it's called for, right? And you kind of want a little more dialogue between the two of them, and, you know, just lines that are a little more knowing, a little more explicit about what they're thinking, I think would have been great. There's just a lot of missed opportunities. I got to say, one of the other weaknesses is just in the set choices and the set design, because they obviously reused the same set of the sky base for the receiving transmat thing on the planet. Yeah. So it's the exact same set. So that's just practically dumb, because it's just like, well, now I'm confused where the characters are. Like, there was a point where Sondergaard comes in with the mutants in the set, and the first thought Grace and I both had were like, wait, how did he get to the sky base? And then we're just, oh, right, this is the other place that looks exactly the same as the sky base. And so,
yeah, I like, didn't get that either. Yeah.
Would it have been that hard to like put a freaking towel up or something, or like something to make it look different so that it was clear?
Like, color sheet over the lights, just change the lighting a little bit.
Totally.
And it's funny, they went through such trouble in the 70s to try and match the things that were on film with the things that were in the studio. But yeah, something like that, didn't pay attention at all. And speaking of going back and forth, so we have another transmat kind of situation, mm-hmm. Called transfer cubicles here. But again, it brings up too many questions today, right? Yes, it's a kind of a nice, cheap way for any science fiction script to get you from the ship or the orbiting station to the planet, which is something you often need to do in science fiction without too much of messing around in a shuttle. But again, just as we were talking about the Ark in Space, really brings up too many questions. Are you killing people at one end and reconstituting them at the other? You know, if you can do that, why wouldn't you say beam up all the people from Solos and put them on a separate station if you want to keep your segregation situation and, you know, not bombard them. It wouldn't take too much to, doesn't seem like there's a lot of them down there. You know, instead of just hunting them down, which takes a lot of time and energy, just transmat them up, or, you know, save them. You don't even need a separate station. Like, again, we talked about this time delay element in the Ark in Space. Like, if you can beam someone from one point to another, it doesn't have to be immediate. It could be months later once you've terraformed the planet. Just brings up two new questions now, but obviously didn't at the time. It's much more of a hindsight thing.
The whole beaming thing, like, I mean, you know, it's obviously just a plot device to quickly cut to things, but I think you could sort of justify that it's not actually destroying you and reconstituting you, depending on the technology. And I think if you're somewhere, because the other issue with beaming is that why can't you just duplicate people? If you're literally like saving them and then reconstituting them with some matter, you should be able to like rebeam people again and again. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to sort of buy into the fact, the idea anyway, that they're somewhere. They're not there. They're somewhere. They're passing through some other thing. And I suppose what you could think about is like, well, what if it was like wormholes? What if these were like a micro wormhole that you just suddenly project around every atom of a person? So that it's literally the same matter. It's just going through an artificial way of folding through space. If that's the technology, then that kind of solves some things. But that sounds like really hard technology, even harder than the stuff we generally think of as a transporter.
Personal wormholes, though, you're absolutely right. You've got my headcanon going on matter transference and beaming down now, so appreciate that.
They'd have to be more explicit about it at some point. Another thing that's pretty inconsistent here, not within the story, but in Doctor Who, where the Doctor like resists a lot of radiation. Like, Professor Sondergaard is like in a radiation suit and he needs a break. He falls down and the Doctor just leaves him. This was just also one of those guys like, what? You're just leaving the guy there, even though he's clearly not doing well. And you don't really know how far you have to go yet. You know, in other words, he could be leaving him to die. That was a very hold it kind of moment for me. But the Doctor keeps going, wearing only his tuxedo. And he gets the crystal and comes back, no problem, which is like... How? Like, because
doesn't he die of radiation? I haven't seen Planet of Spiders, but like, isn't
he has died of radiation. I mean, Planet of Spiders arguably is something a little different, but he definitely dies of radiation when he's the 10th Doctor. Like, he gets a big dose of it and he has to regenerate. And we also see him taking radiation pills in Destiny of the Daleks, which we were at not too long ago. So what is the deal?
Maybe a Time Lord's body can take only so much radiation, can absorb only so much radiation, and then it's full up, and then anything beyond that is dangerous. So if the Pertwee regeneration hadn't been so cavalier, the Doctor in Caves of Androzani, for one thing, could have, because that was radiation as well, right? Spectrox.
No, that was poison.
Oh, no, that was poisoning. Yeah. But yeah, maybe like that's why the 10th Doctor has to die. Maybe that's why he's so pissed off. And he's like, oh, God damn it. The dude in a tuxedo messed up my favorite regeneration.
It's like, it's totally only a one-time thing for Time Lords, I guess. Like, it doesn't even carry over from, you don't get a reboot every regeneration on, on your radiation intake. Okay.
Yeah, you're at like maximum Neville now. Like, maybe the Doctor's, maybe Destiny of the Daleks reveals something more. Maybe he's just on a course of radiation pills in general. I guess take them every day, like statins.
Like it, sure. Maybe he's just doing it for show, for Romana. I don't know.
Maybe it also ties into the healing that he needs to do with the telepathic circuits at the end of Frontier in Space. Maybe he's more open to injury at this point. I don't know. We can headcount this about 10 million ways.
Speaking of Time Lords, I think we have to unpack, like, literally unpack the box they've left us here.
Yes.
Because what the hell?
Mystery
like,
box.
Yeah, they give it, like, they're the most cryptic assigners of missions. Like, they don't tell the Doctor anything. They just program the TARDIS, give him the box, leave him to figure it all out. The box just has these tablets that he's supposed to give to Kai, but
Kai couldn't figure it out.
Wait, this is the thing. This is one of the other weak. We were talking about how weak Kai is. One of the other problems with it is he gets these tablets and he just kind of ditches them because they're not weapons, leaving the Doctor and Sondergaard to figure them out. And they do, but it's like, well, why was that for Kai in the first place? And why were these even in the possession of the Time Lords? Right? Like, shouldn't these be on Solas somewhere? You feel like there's this whole CIA pre-adventure on Solas or something where some Time Lord sort of gets them and somebody dies and hands them to him or whatever, because he's running from the Marshal's goons, and he takes them back to Gallifrey and they realize there's some Solas plays some key thing in the far future. So it's like, get this back. The Doctor's got to make sure that gets sorted out because the Marshal is screwing up this fixed point in time.
It would be lovely if the Doctor sent it to himself in the end, that was the revelation. But yeah, you kind of have to headcanon what's going on there, and maybe headcanon it in the wider plot of the fact that the Doctor is exiled to Earth at this stage. Mm. Like, this whole adventure is just a test by the Time Lords. It's not really discussed why they're letting him do this. Is this the first time? Because obviously the Time Lords would do this a lot during quote-unquote exile. Like, he gets a lot of side quests. Is this the first one?
No. Colony in Space, I think, was definitely one of these. This is like, might be the third or something.
Do you remember second or third? How the Time Lords contact him in the other ones?
It's very similar. It's always just, the only time you see a Time Lord prior to Three Doctors is in Terror of the Autons.
Right, the Time Lord in the bowler hat. Yes, we've been there. such a weird way.
Curse of Peladon, of course. Curse of Peladon was similar. So this is like the third, the second. This is definitely at least the third time they've done this. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Talk about using prison labor. goodness, the Doctor's in exile, and they're using him for all these quests. You've got to headcanon it, I think, as it is a test for the Doctor. That's why it's so inscrutable. That's why it's a mystery box, and you have to get this particular guy to open it. You know, so it means you have to be in this place at this time, and then you have to find the professor who will help you. And like, it feels almost
testing
like a video
him for
game,
what
right?
though? For the three Doctors to be released from his exile, you have to pass these logic problems to get your dematerialization circuit back? It just sounds so silly.
Haven't we had several indications, though, that the Doctor's education was not quite complete?
That's true.
Have dropped out of college.
I think he passed with 51% on the second attempt.
Yes.
According to Romana.
Maybe to have him as one of their agents, the Time Lords are just sort of embarrassed at his academic, his lack of academic prowess. And so this is all like, this is extracurricular. This is extra credit. You're going to bring him up to scratch for, I guess, the Time Lord civil service. He just has to complete these tasks, which seem very, very video game-ish.
He's going to answer all these.
Playing Myst.
Mm. Yeah. Well, he's got to answer a lot of questions on the test, I'm sure. Yes. But, you know, we have our own questions to answer about the mutants. And, of course, those are the four questions to Doomsday. All right. First question. Why did the randomizer take us here?
Well, it's, I mean, take your pick, my goodness. Frontier in Space to this, the mutants, the mutant that features in Frontier in Space, you know, the Doctor intro on a space mission. It primarily, I fear that it is my request for more bright lines in a political conflict on a planet that brought us here. Sorry, everyone. But hey, we got through it.
I think it wants us to get mutant bingo. And we won't get mutant bingo, by the way, until we do the Brain of Morbius. Because now that we've done Frontier in Space and the mutants, we have the two appearances of the mutants in the Pertwee era. And you sort of see that costume anyway, again, one last time in the Brain of Morbius.
Oh, wow.
So I think it's really working on mutant bingo.
I'm so glad those bugs have checked out once they checked in.
So, by the way, I mentioned in our Frontier in Space podcast that the famous Pertwee sort of publicity photo that was taken around this time.
Yeah.
And I've sort of misremembered it, I realize now, because I thought it had a mutant on it. It doesn't, because I actually have the photo. I found it. I got this at a convention in the 80s, and you can see it's Pertwee. If you watch it on YouTube, it I'm holding up the photo.
Can you hold it up to the
camera? So I'm going to get it even closer. It's Pertwee with the Sea Devil and Cyberman and a Dalek. Wow. And the funny thing, like, I got this in the 80s. It's sort of signed by Anthony Ainley.
What?
That's funny. And, but on the back, Katie Manning.
Oh, hey.
Got Katie Manning to sign it. So anyway, just thought I'd throw that in. Kind of funny that this is a thing. But there is no mutant in the photo. So I wanted to set the record straight on the famous
Pertwee publicity photo. Well, just draw one on the back and pretend that Katie Manning did it.
Exactly. So thanks for Randomizer for making me make that connection back to the 80s convention in Spokane, Washington.
Wow, fabulous. Yeah, the randomizer clearly wants to punish me for saying that we were sick of being earthbound with Pertwee. Sorry, randomizer. Yes, we were not. Yes, he was in space a lot. I get it. He did his own space operas. Gotcha.
He wore green and red. So he has the red jacket in this one, the green one in Frontier in Space. So, styling man.
Yes, I didn't realize that. Okay, thanks for putting that out, randomizer.
Mm-hmm. Randomizer likes complementary colors.
He does.
All right. I think we've mined that, for all the randomizer reasoning.
Yes.
So moving on to
time to decolonize that question. And betcha. Move on.
Second question, what if the evil plot had succeeded?
Okay, so the evil plot is the Marshal.
Right, no question.
He wants to terraform the planet at all costs, even if it means killing the inhabitants. I presume that means that we're going to say that the missile attack on the planet works.
We can unpack whatever you want, but I like to, when I think about this question, think about the last thing that prevents the person from doing the thing, and that thing doesn't work generally. So in this case, in episode 6, they can't get the crystal to Kai in time, and he dies from the radiation, or basically everybody in that room dies. The Doctor is still betraying the Marshal, so he's already setting up the booby trap. So the thing blows up in Jaeger's face, just like it does, but the Marshal then it basically shoots the Doctor for his betrayal. And so presumably he regenerates into Tom Baker, and the Marshal tries to, you know, to keep his plan going, which is to say terraform the world. So gets, you know, coaxes Jaeger into doing it, maybe gets the Tom Baker Doctor to help him. But what we can't forget is the Time Lords are involved, right? So if the Doctor's not doing his job, they're going to presumably step in and get someone else to do it.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe Romana can come in early and fix this mess. It is interesting, by the way, isn't it, that the Marshal talks about calling Terraform Solus New Earth.
You
know, long ahead of the New Earth in the new series. But so it's Tom Baker, but he's clearly not going to win release from his exile, especially presuming Joe is dead.
It seems like the Time Lords would need to come and clean up his mess somehow, mm-hmm. and then send him back to Earth, and then the Tom Baker Doctor has to, one, convince the Brigadier that he's who he is, and B, hey, I'm sorry, but Joe's dead. So it's kind of like this dark turn in Doctor Who history.
And Tom Baker, all Tom Baker stories are UNIT stories, because the Time Lords aren't going to liberate him now. I mean, I guess the Three Doctors still happens. Maybe it's the Four Doctors.
Yeah, can you imagine? Tom Baker just seems like the Doctor you definitely don't want bound to Earth for like exile. Like he's the guy who's always out and in a spinning TARDIS somewhere in space and just doing stuff, man.
I mean, he did have his own share of UNIT stories, but you got to think sooner or later.
But he always felt more like a freelancer then, as opposed to having it be his job as Pertwee did. So, I feel like you have a different off.
The Tom Baker Doctor gets distracted and starts writing a blog about Earth candies and why jelly babies are his favorite.
Well, I just feel like you have a less successful Doctor Who after this, and it sort of ends after a couple of seasons of Tom Baker because no one wants to see him on Earth, stuck on Earth, and we don't have the show. it just ends around 1975, 76.
Would he still meet Sarah Jane Smith is the question.
It's all good questions.
So many questions from this evil plot. But so funny how many of these evil plot questions end with what would the next Doctor do in this situation?
But ultimately, I just don't think the Marshal can succeed because of the Time Lords being involved. Now, if he does, if he somehow gets the missiles and changes the atmosphere, does that then screw up the whole web of time or whatever? Because presumably the Time Lords are invested in Solus being this, you know, normal, like basically going back to status quo and having this 2,000-year evolutionary cycle for some reason. I mean, maybe the super Solonians at some future point just become big galactic players or something. Like they seem to become these omnipotent beings or something.
I
don't know why they're even restricted to a planet at that point.
Maybe they can follow the worm and arc in space and just become spacebound creatures, and maybe they're the ones who go and invade Nova Station, meeting Tom Baker at that end.
All right, well, moving on to the third question, which is, where is the Clara Splinter? Clara Oswald, of course, splintered in time at the end of The Name of the Doctor. She is somewhere in every single story of Doctor Who, doing something in the background. What is she doing here in The Mutants?
Well, either she is the leader of the women of Solus, who's taken them all off, all of the women off on some random adventure to get them out of the way of all this nonsense. Maybe they go have a spa day while this is all happening, or they're off on an adventure vacation. But I also think that she might be, like we talked about Time Lord Clara, we know exists from The Name of the Doctor. She's the one who gives the Doctor the advice to take the busted Type 40 TARDIS in the first place. Maybe she's also the Time Lord who is sending him the puzzle box.
Oh, she's CIA Clara.
Yes.
Interesting. The Clara Intervention Agency.
Clara in action. Clara in action. Yeah, yes. We're going to discover that all of the Time Lords are basically founded by Clara. She, you know, this the level below the Timeless Children. There's this whole other plot with Clara involved. But yeah, what else have you got for Clara Splinters?
There's no real reason for all the missiles to malfunction and hit the surface at one point, which is like in episode 4, I think. And I think she's got to be a junior engineer on Skybase, essentially working for Jaeger, but sabotaging those missiles so they don't explode in the atmosphere. And she just kind of knows the Doctor can clean up the mess better than he would be able to reverse the terraforming in the atmosphere.
Mm.
So
she's the Jägermeister.
Yeah, she's snippy.
I meant to ask you, by the way, the
might sound three, effect that one.
there are like three dad jokes at the end of this thing, at the end of the last episode of The Mutants. Like, there's the, oh, we've got to go back to the broom closet because we made a clean sweep of this. There's a repeat of the Doctor Who joke. Doctor Who, did you say?
Right.
As our resident dad joke expert, Pete, what did you think of that?
Well, that's why I'm rating this one a dollar, Chris. It's the dad jokes. Wait, whoa, I jumped to the last question.
Whoa.
I'll give it 7 out of 10 on the dad jokes on there. No, I thought the Doctor Who one, it's always a bit of a dopey joke, honestly. I don't know. I think this speaks a little bit to the juvenile writing that I spoke about last time in Frontier in Space, that they're kind of pandering. I mean, I guess it doesn't explain so much later when they did this stuff in the John Nathan Turner era, but this, when you're explicitly sort of writing for kids, you're going to sneak stuff like this in. But I actually like, I will say, I do like the Doctor and Joe in this one because they're about a year and a half or so into the two of them together. They're very clearly at ease with each other, really like each other. And I kind of like how it begins with the Doctor saying to Joe, "This is too dangerous. You got to stay here." And she's like, "Oh no, you don't." And goes out, like, basically he tries to keep her out of it, but he doesn't try very hard. Yeah. You know, yeah. He basically is like, "All right, I guess you're coming with me." And there's a lot of moments between the two of them like that, like the joke at the end and the stuff in the beginning. They're kind of joking with each other at the beginning. Mm-hmm. There's some laughing about their situation, and they're just clearly friends. And there's a very nice easygoingness between the two of them. And there's a really good point at some point where the marshal has taken Joe prisoner and forcing the Doctor to do what he wants. But the Doctor gives her a smile at some point, like, "It's going to be okay." Like, that sort of reassuring thing that he does. And that's all really, really good.
He does that as well with Sorensen in the, when he and Sorensen are staying in the lab and Joe has to go, he gives her a smile, like, "It's all going to be good." He's definitely taking his duty of care seriously here with a companion. That there's clear affection between her. He takes her hand a lot. And it's just lovely. It's kind of a, you know, lovely father-daughter kind of vibe going on there.
Absolutely. All righty. So a couple possibilities for Clara. And it's time to move on to the last question, the ultimate question, the only question that matters for the mutants. What did we think of this story? The Pull to Open rating system, of course, is 5 ratings. There's the Dalek, which is what we give to a good episode of Doctor Who. The Ogron, which we give to a not-so-good episode of Doctor Who. The Professor Hater, which is what we give to a not-so-good episode, but hey, at least they tried something, at least we learned something. The Viscount Banger, which we reserve for the best of the best. And the rarely used Fixed Point in Time, which is a story that is beyond rating. We can't rate it, sometimes for reasons of nostalgia, but also for other reasons. Alrighty.
You know, I almost want to add a rating to our system here, because the word that comes to mind, I may have used it already, is wallpaper. It's a mess as a story, but it's very pleasant wallpaper to kind of have on in the background, maybe not pay too much attention to, kind of a music video, an embryo. But absent that, I'm sorry, I'm going to give it a reluctant Ogron.
Harsh.
It's one of the better Ogrons, but I don't feel that I could, in good conscience, recommend it to our audience. So I don't want to give it the Dalek. So I don't like, it's just too much of it. And it's too much of a mess. And if you're actually sitting down to seriously watch it, I think you're going to be pausing it a lot and getting confused a lot and distracted a lot. It's not as bad as its reputation.
Yeah.
I would maybe switch that to a Professor Hater if I could think of something they tried. Maybe it's that they tried all of these political ideas to shoehorn them into the script. So maybe it's Professor Hater.
You're kind of spoiling my rating because I think this is a textbook hater. I'm rating a Professor Hater for pretty much exactly what you just said. I almost rated it a Dalek. I'll be honest. Mm. I was surprised at how much I liked it this time, but that's also because, like I said, when I was a kid, everything sort of went over my head and I just saw it as a sort of boring Pertwee every day. Oh, he's just doing another thing. And it's not as fun as seeing Daleks or Ice Warriors or whatever. So I do think the doing something overtly anti-colonial with some clear sort of messages about evils of segregation, et cetera. I think that's what I'm giving most of the points for. But also this time around, I did find myself enjoying someone a portrayal so evil as the Marshal. Even though it probably does get this is definitely one of the longer episodes, like too long. Like this is too long. Like 4 episodes would have done it just fine. Mm-hmm. But I think because you see too much of the Marshal, like you do kind of like it, even that gets repetitive after a while. So there's a lot wrong with it. We talked about it, like the sets, the mutants, which are underused, all the effects we talked about, the dumb resolution with the wall blowing up, etc. Lots and lots of problems.
The cold open that even Barry Letts thought looked like the opening of Monty Python.
Yeah, exactly.
It's guy.
But I will say, like, at least they tried something. They did try to do an interesting sort of anti-colonial tale set in the future. And I'll give it points for that. It sort of does the job.
You've convinced me. I'm making mine a hater too. It's a hater.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Good job advocating there. Once we brought our investigators in, and by the way, I kind of love the investigators, like proto Time Lords in their nappy little rose gold kind of caps there. Just need some big collars. They're almost Time Lords. But yeah, once we bring the investigators in and put this thing on trial, I think Professor Hayter is the right verdict. So, yeah,
the right verdict. All right, we need to get like some kind of tweed jacket that we can both put on when we do a Hayter. I think.
And a bow tie. Concentrate on fish and chips.
All right.
Yes. All right.
I'll come and call wardrobe. Time. Yeah. In the meantime, let's get back into our TARDIS and activate. Let's
go back into the broom closet because we've made a clean sweep of the mutants.
Get us away from here, randomizer, before the dad jokes multiply. God, and I didn't even do that one. The randomizer, of course, consisting of two parts. The first part, the codex, is in front of me. It is a list of every single story that has ever been broadcast in the television show Doctor Who. There are 302 of them.
Yes.
And we have done almost 100 of them.
Yes. Oh, wow. Yeah, well, almost.
Almost. Getting there.
The almost is doing a lot of lifting there. yeah, by the way, but last week when I did the intro of like the show we call Doctor Who, and you said, what else would we call it? Well, I realized belatedly that there are many, many answers, but one of them is Dr. Mysterioso, which is, I was believed, taken from the Mexican title for Doctor Who.
Wow. Anyway, yes. All right. Well, that reveals a little something about a Capaldi episode, I'll say.
Yeah, maybe you want to take us to Capaldi episode randomizer. But yes, what is the actual number? It is 214. 14! Okay. All right, we're so close. So I take the numbers 1, numbers 214, and plug them into the executor, which bears a remarkable similarity to the website random.org, which creates true randomness. Not pseudo-randomness based on an algorithm. Not the kind of randomness we were talking about last week with the Rand Corporation's book of a million random numbers. No, this is bespoke randomness based on atmospheric noise, based on how many of the terraforming gases are hanging around in Earth's atmosphere. That's about as random as it gets, watching atoms bounce around in an atmospheric space. So that's how we generate our random number. It seems the most Doctor Who-ish way to do it. But we also risk our necks by giving the randomizer challenges, daring to challenge the mighty god of randomness. And I got to be careful on this one because There was definitely a three wishes of the genie kind of situation going on last week where it gave me what I wished for and I didn't really want it.
Yeah, so how about I go first on the challenges? So I now know better than to directly ask the randomizer for things I want. But I, taking my comments on the evil of the marshal in this one and how one-dimensional he is, I'm going to ask the randomizer, give us something a little more interesting with regard to evil. Especially since I recently listened to the Big Finish story, Master, which is obviously about the Master and has Sylvester McCoy. And it's just an interesting unpacking of the Master's evil and really kind of tries to explore it and his true motivations. So it gets me thinking, like, I want to see more dimensionality to my evil somehow, wherever that may be. So, take us to some interesting explorations of evil, randomizer.
Oh, yeah. A good anti-hero, as opposed to a bad anti-hero like the Marshal, might be very interesting. A bad guy with layers. Yeah, that sounds great. I'm going to say, please don't just take us to New Who. I think that would be a very lazy request. We know that we are exiled here in the Pertwee era, and it's up to you, dear randomizer, to decide when you want to release us for that exile. However, I think maybe you won't be able to resist this, randomizer. Maybe you won't be able to resist the idea of telling us who your favorite New Who Doctor is.
Oh, wow. Okay. Could be interesting. It'd be interesting. We might be forced to read too much into this selection. We'll see.
Yeah, watch it give us an Old Who episode, just not answer the question at all. Okay. All right. Give me a countdown. We will find out where we're going next.
In 4, 3, 2, 1.
Could I have a lemonade?
195.
Oh, we're way into New Who. Oh, my God. We are at Knock Knock, and we knew the answer was Capaldi. We just knew it. Remember? It was so addicted to Capaldi early on. We had so many Capaldi adventures.
Oh, my goodness.
And now we're back. Bill.
With Capaldi Bill.
Yeah.
We are released from our exile. Capaldi, Bill, and David Suchet, another fine actor to have appeared in Doctor Who.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be an interesting one to revisit. I remember not being super thrilled with it at the time, but I feel like a lot of the things we return to in New Who get better with age. So, yeah, this will be great.
This is a good challenge. I like it. I like it. Not much of a fan of horror myself, but yeah, looking forward to giving this one a rewatch. And again, just so glad to be in New Who.
So glad. And we're so glad that you, listener, have been with us all the time here on our examination of the mutants. Hey, guys, that's just what this podcast is about. It's a podcast. You can go ahead and subscribe or follow to this podcast on whatever app or service you are listening to us on. Don't forget also to follow us on YouTube, youtube.com/pulltoopen. And hey, Spotify listeners, we just gave our rating for the mutants. It's time for you to have your voice. Go ahead, check out the poll feature on your podcast app on Spotify, and go ahead, have your vote, whether it's a Viscount Banger, a Dalek, Ogron, a mutant. Oh no, wait, no, a Professor Hayter. It could be a mutant. We don't know. Maybe he's got claws in his hands.
Into a mutant before the end of Pool to Open.
He might have a healing factor. He might go by the name Nightcrawler. Who knows? All those things are possible. Follow us on the socials. That's also possible. We're at Pool to Open on TikTok, Pool to Open at 63 on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We'll see you here next time, where we will be knock knocking on Knock Knock. Got to get those dad jokes in. It's just got to. I'm obligated, guys. But we'll see you again soon.
It's going to be a dad joke rich one. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Bye, guys.
Take care.